You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome back to The Midpoint. This week, I'm welcoming best-selling author, podcaster and former editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan, Elle and Sunday Times Style, Lorraine Candy. Lorraine has carved out a very impressive career as a journalist, starting at her local newspaper when she was just 17 and going on to write features for some of the UK's biggest publications. After being appointed editor-in-chief at Cosmo, she never looked back and many awards and prestigious postings have followed. And Lorraine has done all of this alongside being a mum of four. Her debut book, Mum, What's Wrong With You? 101 Things Only the Mothers of Teenage Girls Know, harvested a lot of hard-earned wisdom from her experience as a mum. And similarly, her new book, What's Wrong With Me? 101 Things Midlife Women Need to Know, draws on what she's learned about the menopause, often the hard way, as well as what she's learned through her podcast, Postcards from Midlife. And we're also going to chat to entrepreneur and life coach Ed Haddon. He aims to help people discover their purpose in life and unlock their potential. So I'm really interested to hear his thoughts on coaching as a tool in midlife. But first off, let's meet Lorraine. Lorraine Candy, it is about time we had you on The Midpoint. Thank you so much for coming on today. How are you?
Oh, I'm brilliant. Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, no, we had you on our podcast and you were absolutely fantastic and very, very useful and helpful. So I hope I can be too.
That's not always said about me. So being useful is, I mean, you know you're useful, don't you, around the house. You kind of know that these people that you live with couldn't really do it without you, but they don't always relay that back to you.
No, they often use the word useless instead. or they say, what's wrong with you? Every time you use the wrong words for things, or you forget what the remote control is called and things like that.
Which is the title, or it's a version of that, the title of your new book, What's Wrong With Me? But we'll get on to that in just a moment. Anybody listening to this who has read any kind of magazine or newspaper in the last 30 years will probably have come across you, Lorraine Candy, in terms of the volume of work that you've done and the kinds of magazines and newspapers you've worked for. I'm sure the Midpoint audience have been there. But things changed for you professionally around the time that things were changing for you as a woman, and you know, there were a lot of big changes kind of happening all at once.
Yes, I guess we're talking about my sort of mid to late 40s and early 50s when I'd sort of had a 30-year career. I'd started very early, left school at 16, worked as a journalist and edited magazines, worked on newspapers and had four children and got married, done all the Gen X women things. But I started to kind of unravel, I guess you would say, when I was in my late 40s. And it was really unexpected. It was a complete surprise. It was a physical and emotional unravelling. And, you know, lots of things are going on, aren't they, in the midpoint, as you often say. Your children are getting older, they're teenagers, they're about to leave home. Your work circumstances are beginning to change because careers change and everything changes at that stage. And it sort of coincided with what, in retrospect, I found out was the perimenopause, which I mean, you know, I've edited these big magazines and done all this journalism on health and women's health, and this thing was just a complete surprise and it ambushed me. And I think I felt I had to write about that because of the kind of Gen X women that had been around me. You know, I've been writing for them for so long since I edited Cosmo and telling them all these things and doing all these campaigns about date rape drugs, about feminism, about women's rights. And yet at no point had anyone told me, or I'd noticed or found or asked, that this thing was coming at me. And it just felt very unfair not to share it. So as you do as well on this podcast, I just felt we had to share it for the generation behind us. And I was a little bit cross the generation in front of us hadn't mentioned it.
Well, let's wind back to that, because you mentioned Cosmopolitan magazine. And its kind of uber editor, Marcel Dagey-Smith, back in the day, was very famous for wanting to write about women's sex lives. And this was seen as enormously liberating. I think I was a teenager when she was at the helm, and I remember when I was at university, I wrote off and won a competition to be a student ambassador for Cosmopolitan magazine. And it seemed like this really incredibly glamorous place where women's issues were going to be at the forefront. But as you say, up to a point, there was a line in the sand that seemed to have been drawn, an imaginary line in the sand across all magazines and all outlets. Because I'm sure in the other places you worked, this was not something that was top of the agenda.
Well, it wasn't top of the agenda on the Sunday Times when I was there 3 years ago launching a podcast about it. So it's kind of, you know, it's this thing that women seem to be ashamed of. And this, I mean, dare I say it, patriarchal attitude to us not being worth as much as we age. And then there are no role models, so we start to feel invisible. And we're just not there in society anymore. Thankfully, we are a bit more now. But it was something that just, you know, it wasn't going to sell magazines talking about the menopause, perimenopause. It wasn't, women didn't want to read it, men didn't want to read it. And we were kind of working also, you know, sex and power is how you get attention, isn't it? In, you know, in publishing, that those stories get attention, those stories sell. It just wasn't talked about because it was affecting the power structure and this, you know, if you're going to talk about sex, you have to talk about younger women and sex. You have to talk about sexuality within a relationship. And, you know, I think as a generation as well, Gen X, we had such ridiculous stuff happening. And, you know, we had the Ladette culture. We'd grown up in the 70s with Benny Hill. You know, we were still a generation where nurses' outfits were Halloween outfits. I mean, how ridiculous is that? There was so much coming at us and we were working within a system which was set up predominantly by men, which didn't really work for us. So we were trying to fit in a place that didn't work. And, you know, in a way, I look back and think, well, I should have been more questioning. I should have thought that through a bit more and, you know, asked about the women ahead of us. But then, you know, I've interviewed women in their 60s for the book, you know, women like Ruby Wax, who said to me, do you know, it's like childbirth, isn't it? If someone says it's incredibly painful and they tell you the absolute details of it, you still go ahead and do it. So it's, you know, perhaps we wouldn't have listened anyway. But it's been so fascinating unpicking all of this for this generation. And I'm just really hopeful that the next generation, you know, there are, you know, stuff is more important to them and they get the information they need. I mean, I work with Helen Gurley Brown, who set up Cosmopolitan. And globally, wherever it launched from the late 60s onwards, it was number one in every single market. There was such a thirst for it. And her belief was you had to have your own financial independence, you had to have your sexual independence, but it was still quite a man-pleasing tone. As long as you worked within this societal structure, you could be independent. But and also, you know, she was all about women being able to work outside of the home, but there were all these conflicting messages about what you should look like and what you should weigh, and you know, which it was fascinating to go back and look at all of that.
It's almost with hindsight, it was like a slight bending of the glass, but not quite smashing it. You know, trying to kind of make the glass move in some way, but you know, you had to do it within a, as you say, the confines of a patriarchal society, and try and do it in a way that you took people with you, and those that didn't perhaps didn't have the easiest ride, did they? They weren't necessarily able to.
Well, you say it, you know, it was that we were sold, and it's that, you know, we are quite a sort of endurance based focused generation. We were sold this have it all, you can have it all, miss. In fact, that was Helen's catchphrase, and you can't have it all. And we decided that that actually also meant you could do it all. And even, you know, as we progressed through the decades and men were more behind us and more, you know, into the equality in the home sphere, even now, most of the surveys that come out around the emotional labour and the domestic labour, it's all done by women. So, you know, we found that out with COVID, didn't we? During the pandemic, you know, women were working from home and homeschooling and home running, and they were still doing the lists for, you know, you can have, a lot of women were saying, we have the most equal relationship in the whole world. So I do a list of what I want my male partner to do during the day, where in, there's no intrinsic thinking of it being equal. We had an anthropologist, Lucy Cook, on our podcast, and she wrote Bitch, which is a book about animals, female animals in the wild. And she looked at all the surveys and all the science, and there is no maternal instinct. So this is a myth, but we were still buying into it, you know, even, you know.
So in the animal kingdom, nobody, no
There's no maternal or paternal instinct. There's just, you know, it's whoever brings up the baby, you know, whoever looks after the offspring. Right. And then, you know, obviously in many animals that all happens in a different way. way. But it was fascinating to find that out. And we've sort of been told that's part of us and part of our intrinsic DNA, and it's not. It's just not true. It doesn't exist. So I think, you know, when you look at that very basically, we come from that, then you have it all. So try and go to work, try and have a family. And also, you know, I feel a bit guilty that I didn't say, you know, we didn't talk about how difficult that was, and, you know, and how also how difficult staying at home and working at home, bringing up children and not having a job outside the house is really difficult as well. So, you know, I think it's been fascinating to look at, and I really hope things are changing though from those early Cosmo days. But Cosmo did tell women about sex, and that was really needed.
And now a conversation has been, I think, probably amplified because of COVID, actually, because there's a generation of women, of which you are very much at the vanguard of, who've gone, hang on a minute. We weren't told about this. And all this stuff came. It was a perfect storm, wasn't there? It was COVID, and lots of women experiencing, especially women who worked in the media, experiencing these perimenopausal symptoms, then working out what they were. And this is what happened to you, and is your journey through it in your new book, which I think anybody who is at this period of life, any woman before, during or after, will really appreciate your honesty and your candor. And it really is a roller coaster ride through that with four children. And I kind of picked out bits that I think would be particularly kind of relevant for our audience today. You talk about the creeping sadness that happened, which I really recognised as somebody, as you appear to be, that was jolly and found, you know, a lot of positives in life. This came as a massive shock.
I think I had depression. I think that's what I had. And I had, it was such a surprise to feel that there was really no point in anything, and to feel, you know, even darken that on some days. And I was having, for the first time ever, I had a panic attack at the front door as I was leaving for work. I just, you know, the floor started to move. I couldn't breathe. I felt this huge darkness coming towards me. And I checked within the family, because I'd had other physical symptoms, as if there had been any mental illness, whether there were any issues I should know about. And there wasn't. And I'd never felt it before. And I went to the doctor twice to talk about why I felt so god-awful and why I was waking up. I was waking up in the night, not just with night sweats, but the gloom was just horrendous. And I was having these terrible, terrible, I guess you'd call them night terrors, where it was just horrific. And I was waking up screaming, which was so out of character and so odd. And I'd gone to the doctor primarily.
What did you put it down to?
Exhaustion. I was writing a book, I was editing a weekly magazine, I had four children, they were getting older. I thought I was just doing so much. My brain had probably broken, or I had a tumour, brain tumour of some sort, because the other thing, I was completely forgetting great big chunks of things. So I got in the car one morning, and I started the car, drove off, and I couldn't work out which side of the road I was needed. Nothing else was around, and I thought, I don't know. I can't remember which side of the road I should be on. And at that point, I thought, this is really frightening, because it's not that you just can't remember. It's not like you misplaced a surname or you can't remember the word for something. Mm. It's like a chunk of your brain is shut down. And I thought, well, this is dementia. This is something. And that's what... But the depression, I think, was the worst. And I think when you don't sleep as well, it just makes it worse. It's a spiraling thing. And I thought this exhaustion, this tumour, whatever, is making me depressed. And, you know, I was offered antidepressants twice by doctors. And it just instinctively didn't feel right to me. I didn't think that would make... You know, there's always a debate at the moment, isn't there, that, you know, when women are on hormone replacement therapy, as I am, and which kind of cured me, and I was very lucky it did, you know, we're medicalising this part of a woman's natural life. But, you know, we've always medicalised what women need. You know, you can't go through childbirth without being medicalised. But two-thirds of GPs, I found out from a very recent survey 3 years ago, routinely prescribe antidepressants wrongly when they should be prescribing hormone replacement therapy. And it struck me that we've been medicalized. There's whole groups of women being medicalized through this part of their life, when some of them, yes, they may need antidepressants, they really may, and it may work for them, or it may move them forward. But I didn't need that at the time. I needed this darkness to go, this creeping sadness. And it does sort of creep into your life. You just can't see the point of it.
And you, obviously, you know Dr. Louise Newsome very well. You speak about her in the book, and she would also say, as any of the great women and men who work in this field would say, it's not just the symptom of the sadness and feeling low that hormone replacement therapy can help. There's so many other things that we can be helped with as women in terms of osteoporosis prevention and heart health. There's so many other things. And this podcast and yours have looked into that a lot. So hopefully anybody listening who for the first time is thinking about it can go and look at those resources. And you talked about how at the beginning you were just getting up earlier to get all those jobs done. All right, I need more time in the day. I'll get up earlier.
All right, a big list.
My to-do list. And I recognise that, because you think, I must be able to cram. I actually said it to my husband last night, and not because I've just got lots on at the moment. I said, I think I'm going to have to start getting up at 5.
Well, it's madness.
6 is not doing
it. Yeah, it's really, it's madness. You write this great big list, and we have a private Facebook group with the people from our podcast, and a lady had put up this kind of picture of her wall of all these post-its on it of all the stuff she was forgetting. And she was like us, we were getting up so early. I was getting up so early to try and get this stuff done because it was taking me longer and I couldn't remember it and I was trying to figure it all out. And I think what I wanted to get across in the book is this emotional side of what women are going through, because, you know, Louise Newsome's book is brilliant on the practical side, and there's lots of practical books out there, but when you can't forget, when you forget which side of the road to drive on, you just think you're a moron. And you just look at, you come home and you think, I can't remember if I've fed the dog. I can't, you know, you find your keys in the fridge. You boiled some eggs for breakfast and they're not in the pan. And you think, well, have they dissolved? What's happening? You start to think you're slowly going mad. And that really, really undermines you. And that was the bit I found a bit unforgivable with the medical profession and the kind of gaslighting that goes on. I just thought, there's a whole army of us thinking slowly and being really ashamed of ourselves for going mad, for being competent and then gradually becoming incompetent.
More than competent. I mean, you're editing national magazines and running a household. So you go from high performance to feeling like simple tasks are beyond
you. Yeah, and I think this shame is a terrible thing to carry around. And I just don't think any woman should have to deal with that for any length of time. It's a really horrible feeling to have inside you. I interviewed a woman for the book who had been one of the first pilots of long-haul aircrafts, and she'd be one of the first female pilots. And her perimenopause, she couldn't park car. She was, and when someone had asked her what she used to do because she'd retired, she said, I couldn't tell them because I'd think I was such an idiot because I'm so incompetent now. And, you know, and it was some, you know, what she was going through was easily cured by hormone replacement therapy. So I just, this shame, I just felt it's not fair for women to have that. And then you feel like you're doing it on your own. You just think, I'm just slowly, gradually going mad. You know, I found a cucumber in the airing cupboard and I thought, what's that doing there? Why did I put that there? And you just think, what an idiot.
And yet when my teenage son put about 20 quid's worth of frozen prawns into the bread bin, that's fine. That's fine. He's got a lot on his plate, apparently. And that actually brings us nicely on to, you throw teenagers into the mix. Not every woman going through menopause will have teenagers at home, but you throw teenagers into the mix and you've got a whole different world of pain there, because you've got the contrast of their kind of bountifulness and them going into life,
all, you know, collagen.
With all this charge of energy and collagen and everything else. And, you know, and then also their cruelty. You know, they can be very, very cruel in the way they, let's say, process what's happening to you, you know, because they've seen the other version of you and they've seen you run this house like the matriarch you are and, you know, the household. And suddenly the power shifts, doesn't it? Because they can see things unraveling, and it's kind of getting a hold of that. I found getting a hold of that quickly and going to them, saying to them, right, this is what's happened. Turns out this is perimenopause. I'm going to do this about it. And, you know, and actually being really honest with them was one of the best things I think I ever did.
Yeah, I think you have to tell your sons and your daughters, and you have to let them know what you're going through, because, you know, I wrote a book about parenting teens, and one of the things I learned that was really important is their brains are being taken apart, being flooded with hormones and put back together again over a kind of 10-year period. So you've got to be really patient with them when they're building their identity and their brains are being rebuilt. That's a lot for them to go through. And at the same time, your hormones, the estrogen, it's in every single part of your body. It's either fluctuating or decreasing. So you're going through a lot as well. So you've got to share it. And ruptures and repairs are the kind of two, you know, repair in any kind of argument with kids or teenagers is much, much more important than what's caused the rupture in the first place. Mm. How you repair mm. that, how you communicate with them. You know, I was really, really honest, you know, and they'd now go, oh, menopause, shmenopause, every time I, you know, lose my keys or forget a phone number or something, or ask them what my Netflix password is. But yeah, I think you have to, actually, as a whole family, particularly even with male partners as well, explain what's going on. Otherwise, you can't do it on your own, basically. This is not a time to do anything on your own. It's a time to be really vulnerable, to open up, to ask for help. All of the things that Gen X women particularly find quite difficult, I think.
Mm. And you think that is peculiar to Gen yeah. X women as opposed to the generation younger?
Yeah, I do, actually. I was doing, you know, I interviewed lots and lots of people and lots of experts for the book, and younger women are kinder to themselves. They are much softer in their day-to-day because of this, you know, I'm not saying it's everybody and you can't generalize, but I think because of this have-it-all mindset, whether you chose to work or not, you just felt you had to deliver. You know, and I think we were sold that, you know, in the advertising, we were sold that we had to be thin, we had to be beautiful, we had to be sexy, we had to be successful, we had to be also, you know, we had to be the best mothers in the world. It was, you know, in the last 30 years, 25 to 30 years, this theory of attachment parenting, when you have that skin to skin time with your babies and you're supposed to be there all the time and you're supposed to breastfeed until they're 12, you know, that was running alongside the have it all thing. So I think it is peculiar to this generation, actually. I think we are wired to achieve in whatever area we want, you know, we're working in or being at home in. And that's an unbearable pressure. But I think with millennials, and I manage loads of teams of young women, and obviously had lots of younger female readers and listeners, and they are kinder to themselves. They give themselves space to repair themselves. They get the rest. They understand the importance of sleep, I think.
So when it all came to an end at the Sunday Times, and that was your last kind of big job, you talk about struggling to kind of then work out who you were, how you introduce yourself even to people. And at this point, were you managing the hormones and you were on HRT?
Yes, I was. And I think if I hadn't been, I'd probably would have gone, you know, I probably would have had to go and check myself in somewhere. But I'd got the physical help I needed to balance the hormones, to make me feel great, to know I was protecting my future health. But what was also going on, and I think this is why I felt this was worth including, and it's a huge change in identity in midlife. You become a different person because there are a lot of what they call living losses. You do actually lose people. So it's very sad when you lose people you're close to, because people get ill as they get older. Your children leave home. So my two eldest children left home at the same time as my job at the Sunday Times editing style came to an end. And my body had completely changed as well. So you have to adapt to being a new person or a different person or an evolving person. And I was really intrigued as to why, how I was going to deal with that. And what, you know, my identity was so tightly tied to my career because I'd been doing it since I was 17. I just wondered what else would I be if it wasn't there. And I was very tempted at the beginning to rush straight into something else. Or
you talk about that filling the void almost too much, which you can understand. That was the way you'd always been. You'd been a busy person. So did you not just default into kind of how,
yes,
you know, how you were before?
Well, I found out about the void, which was the place I hadn't heard of before, which was a kind of really strange. So I talked to lots of therapists and lots of experts in grief and lots of experts in identity and forming identity through life. And there is this void between Act One and Act Two, and you can't rush through it. You can't just fill it with all the stuff you've had in your life before. You've got to really sit there and feel all those uncomfortable feelings. What would it be if you walk into a room and you're not who you were? What would it be if you know, are you happy in this marriage? Are you happy in this role? Have you handled the end of your children living at home well? All of those thoughts, and you get quite a lot of, which I hadn't read before, you get a lot of flashbacks from the past that keep coming back, and you think, oh, hold on, I thought that was the brilliant decision, actually. Maybe that wasn't a great decision, and maybe I now have to deal with the feelings around that, and maybe I now have to deal with all those feelings that this manic activity, this distraction has moved me away from. And also you also start to realise, because you do the death maths, is I've got less left than I've had. It really has to be important. I really want to enjoy it. What's going to be my purpose? Could I do something totally different? And what I learned is it's not really about reinvention. I think there's this myth that there's a midlife crisis, and I hate that. I don't think it is a midlife crisis.
Yeah, it comes from, I don't know if you know where it comes from. It comes from a 1965 scholar in Canada who was doing a study on a group of genius people, basically. And he observed that there was this questioning in the middle of their lives. And I think his was a much more philosophical way of explaining it. And it's become this kind of, I think, a bit of a lazy trope, hasn't it, really, for people who buy a Ferrari and have an affair or something. Or, you know, actually, we had the comedian Zoe Lyons on. She was very funny. She bought two sports cars and she was joking about the fact that she kind of, she did the classic trope. But it is a crisis, though, in some ways, isn't it? Whether that's melodramatic or not.
Yeah, it's a crisis of identity, but you need to sit and explore that rather than move fast forward into the next thing. Men tend to be dissatisfied. And women, because they go through much more of the kind of physical thing, are confused more than dissatisfied. So there's a brilliant book called The Happiness Curve, which Jonathan Rauch wrote. And he talks scientifically where you go, you dip. The curve, the bottom of the curve is in midlife. But as you come out of it, you become more spiritual. You look for more of a purpose-filled day. Things become more important to you that are smaller, your joy in life, your awe in life. And I looked at all that research, and I looked at the Blue Zones research, which is the research of in the blue zones in the world where people live longest and are happiest. And, you know, all those things that we slightly take for granted, our friends, super, super important. Loneliness is a massive, massive killer. It's really, really dangerous to be lonely and not have, you know, you need four or five good friends, they discovered, to live through this period of turmoil, because it's a little bit of a period of turmoil. You know, you need sleep, you need to move regularly, you need to find a purpose. But these are all sort of small things that you can add in. And I think a lot of us hit this crisis point and think, well, I've got to make a massive reinvention. I've got to, you know, move to the country and be a florist.
Australia.
And, you know, do all these things. And actually you don't, you just have to sit with it and work out in your day what would make it happier, and it all gradually comes together. And I sort of wish I'd known that before I started sort of manically filling my time and doing hundreds of things. The first sort of 2 years at the end of the career, I just filled my time constantly and did the same thing that I did when I was working full-time, editing a book, doing a podcast, traveling the world for fashion shows. Madness. Wasted that time, should have just stepped back. You know, I was very privileged. I had the ability to do that. But you can do it. And I mean, I interviewed women from all kinds of backgrounds, very diverse backgrounds, because I really wanted to explore how it was affecting everybody living all their lives. Just about everyone had taken that moment to look at what's actually happening to them day to day, really.
Do you think that's something that everybody can do, or do you think it's the preserve of people who've got a financial security?
Yes, you do need financial security.
A lot of women have just got to work through, haven't
they? Yeah, but I interviewed a woman who was a social worker and had gone through terrible, terrible perimenopause. But a lot of the changes she made in her day-to-day life around her routine and her finances were so, you know, just taking those moments for herself. And it sounds so woo-woo, and I was so resistant to putting it into the book because it sounded like such a flippant, ridiculous thing to say, you know, get up half an hour earlier, have half an hour to yourself, spend that time learning to breathe properly. Do you know, all of that moving during the day instead of doing loads of exercise, just move gradually in the day, add a glass of water. All of those things are very tiny, but, you know, making sure you're close to your friends and that they're there for you and they're the right people, or you make new friends, phenomenally, phenomenally important, game-changingly important. And I think as a generation, we slightly dismiss it because we say, oh my God, it's this wellness stuff. It's, you know, you can't be happy all the time. But what you learn in the void is how to deal with not being happy. And, you know, it might work out, it might not, but you learn how to deal with both sides of that, I think, if you sit with those feelings and make these minor changes.
And I think you can access your feelings, and again, this might sound a bit woo, but you can access your feelings in a more profound way, because I think when you're that busy and things are kind of filling your mind, you don't take time actually to absorb those. You allude to the fact that people of our generation will experience loss, and we have had a terrible run at the beginning of the year of people our age, you know, who we knew very well, dying, and some quite quickly. And I think that was a big eye-opener for both Kenny and myself, actually. And not because we thought we were going to kind of plow through life not losing people, because we've both lost people at a young age, but suddenly you look at this generation and realize, okay, this is, you know, this is what's going to happen. And how you feel that, I think, is very important anyway, in terms of moving forwards with it. And I think perhaps when you're racing, you just don't have time, do you, to properly feel.
Well, you don't have what they call regulating strategies, do you? You don't have coping strategies, things that you know make you feel better. And, you know, the body always tells the story in the end. The mind-body link is so tight, and we're just beginning to get all the science around that. And if you don't take time to look after you yourself, you can't look after everybody else, and you can't deal with all the stuff that's coming at you. So it is that, you know, I'm not saying that we all need to be happy all the time and calm all the time. We just need to have some things in our toolkit that we can do when we feel like it's spiraling out of control, or we're going through a very, very sad loss or some shocking news. I mean, in this stage of life, you know, that you lose count of the women who have to have lumps in their breasts checked. You lose count of the men who've got to deal with, you know, with prostate cancer as a surprise diagnosis. All of this is happening all the time. So you just need to get some regulating things that can help you deal with all of that. And manically working really fast so you don't think about it is not one of the good regulating things that one can do, I think. And I think, you know, you have to soften slightly in midlife, and that is helpful because then you appear more vulnerable and people will offer to help you. And I think we're not a generation that asks for help as women, so learning to ask for help, you know, I mean, I took up swimming outside because the cold seemed to make me feel, before I took HRT, it seemed to make me feel a lot better. And I'd feel good for 2 or 3 days after a swim in cold water. And I learned to swim properly to do it. And I found this group of women around the lakes and the seas who were just so, so helpful. Strangers, really, when I met them. But they've been so supportive when, you know, difficult, traumatic things have happened in life. And I've learned not to judge anyone's situation. Everybody goes through this in midlife. It is inevitable. You will have these living losses, and you can lose people, lose your job, you lose your kids leaving, lose your youth, you lose your fertility. All of this is a lot to deal with, and you need people around you and some strategies to help you with it. And you need to know it's coming, I think.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Okay, I want to bring our guest on today, and actually there's a link in a way, because in your book you talk about Alex Villas, who's a coach who helped you when there was a lot of changes when you were at L, was that right? And so you've experienced some coaching.
Yes, I did. And we were merging the digital team with the print team, and, you know, fashion magazines are fairly hierarchical, so there's quite a bit of status. And I got rid of my office and I sat on we had an open plan hot desk built round the fashion cupboard, so we would have digital and print content coming out the fashion cupboard. And I knew that moving out of my office as editor-in-chief would be tricky for people. So I wanted some coaching on how I could still deliver what the business needed, but maybe alter my leadership style so that I could sit among all the staff and it wouldn't unnerve them and it wouldn't be difficult for me to get my job done, and I'd still have authority, but also that we wouldn't all be working at my, you know, fairly manic, energetic pace. That would have been unfair for people. So he was incredibly helpful actually on that. And I actually re-interviewed him for the book, and he talked a lot about the CEOs he sees now, Gen X people, who just are really not very forgiving of themselves and then suddenly realise that they have to be because, you know, it doesn't work out forever.
Well, I feel like I'm hearing more and more people using business coaches and life coaches, and it feels like something that we're more receptive to than, say, we would have been 20, 30 years ago. And obviously, coming from the background of sport, I find all the ex-sports people I work with now in telly are so coachable. You know, if they ask for advice, they want to know what, you know, how to get better and how to perform better. So it's interesting to me kind of how people come to coaching and where they come to it from. So we're going to bring in Ed Haddon, who is a former GB rower and now has turned his life into coaching in business. He's written a book called The Modern Maverick after he did a master's in experimental psychology from Oxford University. And the book's catchline is why writing your own rules is better for you, your work and your world. So hopefully Ed can explain to us what that means exactly. Hello, Ed. Thank you so much for coming on The Midpoint.
Gabby, thank you so much for having me on the show. And it's lovely. What a lovely conversation to listen to. I was writing down a list of things to link to and I ran out after about 20.
Oh, good. Good. Well, tell me what you heard then that piqued your interest.
I think this really, I mean, we can talk a bit about coaching and how that can help in a minute. But this, the words that really sprung out for me is this word of should. So I should be doing this and I should be doing that. And what's my identity and how do I need to shape my identity to what the world thinks I should be doing? And I think that is what a lot of people carrying around with them. And this idea that we're living a life that maybe isn't ours, that we're kind of almost renting from someone else. And I should be doing this and I should be doing that. And I think a lot of coaching conversations really examine that and really help people pull that idea apart. What do you really want to be doing? What are you on this world to do, I guess, rather than what should you be doing? So it was a lovely conversation to listen to. Thank you.
Well, tell me how you would, when somebody comes to you and they say they want some help, how you would guide them to find the thing that they should be doing. They shouldn't say they should be doing something. What's the word they should use then?
Yeah, I think what they really want to be doing. I mean, we talk a lot. There's a book by David Brooks that I recommend a lot called The Second Mountain. And it's the idea that we spend the first part of our careers climbing this first mountain that I think you've both talked about a lot today, of very career-centric and filling the void, as Lorraine talked about. And you get to the top of the mountain and sometimes it's not quite what you thought it was going to be. You may have achieved everything you set out to achieve, but there's a sense of sometimes a feeling of emptiness or this creeping sadness, as Lorraine talked about. And then you enter this valley and you think, well, what am I going to do now? You know, what does the second mountain look like? And a lot of my clients try and climb the first mountain again and try and repeat the same process. But I think the work that we do together is saying, well, actually, what is your own definition of success? We hear a lot in society about what success looks like, you know, money, power, fame, likes, whatever it is. But what is your own real definition? What does success really mean to you? And we talk about a broader definition, a definition that doesn't just perhaps include a career, that includes a family, how you are at home, how you are as a friend, how you are in your community, and try and create a really personal version of, look, what does, if we look forward in 5 or 10 years, what would a really good life look like to me and the people that are important to me? And this idea of moving from maybe being a passenger in one's life where you're filling a void that you might not be aware of what it is, to really saying, well, look, I'd like to be a pilot. I'd like to really work out what I want to do, what I'm kind of uniquely good at. And also, most importantly, the book talks about what is then in the service of others, mm-hmm. right? It's not just self-help for myself. It's self-help so that I can help others, because we know that kind of sits at the core of happiness and fulfillment and a life well lived.
So that is the world in writing your own rules. Is it better for you, your work and the world?
Yeah, exactly. And I think Lorraine talked really well about, look, without looking after yourself, there's no hope of helping others or helping your children or being a great CEO at work. And it's this idea of putting self first, but so you can be of service to others. So if you're clear on what you want to do, what you enjoy doing, you know, and what the world needs, you know, you are a different, more positive person with more to give. Your family really benefits. You know, we all know those times when we're away from our families a lot, or we come back and we're not really present. Mm-hmm. So we come back, but we're not, you know, we're on our phones or we're thinking about work. So this idea of for you to be clear and in balance about what you want to do, your family benefit, but also the world, as you say, as a larger, whether it's your people at work, whether it's your direct teams, or whether it's the people you come into contact with, everyone benefits from this idea of you living your best life, your life on the purpose of your what you're here to do. And it's this kind of ripple effect. But it does start with the work that you've been talking about today about, well, look, what is right for me, not what should I be doing for others, if that makes sense.
And what we were talking about specifically was this period of life, very specifically in women's lives, when the, you know, when they're perimenopausal and menopausal, and there's the physical as well as the emotional and the mental kind of barrage to deal with. You obviously have clients from a wide range of ages and, you know, different positions in their lives, different stages of their lives. Why do people kind of come to you in the first place? Or are they all kind of late 40s, early 50s, the kinds of people you're dealing with?
Yeah, it's a good question. We tend to see people at these quite key stages. There are a group of sort of early 20s. So first, what do I do with my life? And we tend to refer those on to other coaches we work with. We tend to pick people up sort of mid-30s, mid-40s, mid-50s. Those are the kind of the key, you know, and of course there's variants in there, but there are these periods in life where maybe it's young children, kind of teenagers or children, as you say, empty nesting, that these cause big changes in our identity, our sense of who needs us now. But we do a lot of work in this kind of midlife, this midpoint stage, which your brilliant podcast is about, because it is that softening, as Lorraine really put really well, of actually what really matters now. You know, as you say, we're losing friends, we're being confronted by death. We work a lot with entrepreneurs who've had their own businesses and have had success there, but they've given a lot. You know, that it's a very binary thing, being an entrepreneur and a founder and having your own business. And we talk about this idea that how do we broaden an idea of success, and how do we recognize some successes that you may not give value to, you know, having a brilliant family or having a brilliant relationship, a sort of sanctuary and a safe place at home where children are growing up in a good place. And so that's the work, really, about recognizing maybe some things that you're doing well that you didn't realize you were, and actually looking at what do you want to change that perhaps, you know, you're not so happy with.
And I wonder, Lorraine, bringing you into this as well, if, you know, this is really important that people recognize all of these things at this stage of their lives, but what we'd, I suppose, hope for in the future is that people are growing through their 20s and 30s and having families and realizing that. And they, while they're going to deal with the physical manifestation of midlife, whatever that looks like, that they get there and they've got that other stuff sorted. Yeah. So it doesn't have to come all at once, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think advance notice of anything, any big change, because, you know, change is what we're dealing with all the time. And advance notice of that is really helpful. I started doing something which was so out of character, and I just said, ridiculous, I'm not going to do that. Journaling. Which brought me, it's the maddest thing, but I thought, I'll do it because I am a writer. Started as a writer, I am a writer. It kind of makes sense for me to do it, but I won't call it journaling. I'll just write down stuff I'm thinking about. One of the things that kept coming up again and again, and it came up in the research and it came up as I started this journaling, is this gratitude, this idea of gratitude. So you become ever more grateful for being here as you get older, because it's a privilege to get old, you know, because the alternative is terrible. So getting older, you start to see gratitude in your day, and it started to appear in lots of surveys and science that I was reading around getting older and longevity. That idea, a sense of maybe getting that earlier on, I think would make this bit a lot easier. You know, you can have the worst day and, you know, be at someone's hospital bed and all of that, but still feel joy that it's sunny when you walk home. And it sounds so ridiculous. And just writing it down made me feel so silly, as I guess a Gen X woman, are not into that woo-woo stuff. But it's over the year that I've been doing it has gradually built and built. And I think it's a real mainstay of keeping me stabilized. It's one of those regulatory strategies. And if we could get young people doing it, it'd be great.
Yeah, and I totally agree. I put something on my social media about gratitude a few weeks ago, and enormous response from people who similarly had started really consciously being grateful for things and realizing that sometimes it is tiny, tiny things that, you know, and this sounds ridiculous, but I got given a puppy for my 50th birthday last week, and I didn't know I needed a puppy, and I didn't know I was getting a puppy. And of course, I'm at home today, and I've been writing, and I had to keep taking the puppy out for a wee. And just noticing how green the grass was and how lovely, you know, how the smell of freshly cut grass. And I really had this moment of kind of being grateful for that and having some grass that I've got some, that's a quote that's going to get taken out, isn't it? I've got my own grass. But that was kind of a moment. And I thought, yeah, that these are coming more frequently and every day there's something that seems tiny. Ed, is that something that you have worked on with your clients and you notice that there needs to be an increase of?
Yeah, I think I'd love to sort of pick that word woo-woo up that you almost put in inverted commas and sort of call it out a bit, because that is now a whole field of psychology called positive psychology. So when I read psychology, it was about helping the mentally unwell sort of assimilate in society. Now, yeah. You know, Martin Seligman in the 90s said, well, hang on, what about helping well people really flourish, yeah, right? Yeah. So, you know, gratitude, journaling, they're brilliant. They're now scientifically underpinned ways of, you know, helping boost your happiness, increase resilience, and so you're ready for some of that, to manage some of the downs that we inevitably get. And I would add, you know, to sort of journaling and gratitude, I'd add exercise and that you know lots of people know about, but that and cold showers, as you say, that endorphin hit, you know, that can last for days, it really works. So the first half of the book is really about, look, what do I really want to do? How do I take control of my life? How to become that sort of pilot of my life? The second half is deeply practical. So it's about, look, let's get some of these practical underpinnings. It's a bit like, let's get our batteries fully charged here. So let's think about exercise and what we're eating. Let's think about journaling. Let's think about some of these habits in a way that we can build in cold water swimming. They're not all going to be for you, but try them. And if you can assemble your own little bespoke kind of toolkit, if you like, and build a habit around that, that makes a massive difference, both in trying to make positive changes, but also riding some of those inevitable storms that we encounter.
And before I let you go, Ed, can you tell us how you went from GB rower to studying experimental psychology?
Well, I was doing the two at the same time, which was quite challenging. So I was rowing while I was at university. But then I think the rowing was part of this sort of ambition and desire to sort of succeed in a sort of certain way. That was my first mountain, if you like. And I went on to do a number of jobs that I wasn't suited for. It was a bit like Adrian, I was listening to your talk with Adrian, where he said, look, when I got offered the job by ITV, it was too good to refuse. Mm-hmm. And I think I went through, I see a lot of clients who've been reactive in their careers, who get an offer and they go, oh, I'll take that. That sounds great. And then suddenly 20, 30 years in, they're like, oh, how did I end up
as a management consultant?
How did I get to here? Yeah, I was. That was my first job. Bingo. So it was a great grounding, but it wasn't me and it wasn't right for me. So I think the earliest you can sit with someone, the coach is there to ask you really difficult questions that we don't ask ourselves. We think we will, but we don't. So the earliest you can sit with someone and actually create a bit of a plan, it's not going to go straight to plan, but it's a clear idea of, look, here's what I really love to do. Here's what I'm really good at. Here's where I think I can have an impact. And here's why I'm doing it, rather than this kind of reactive, oh, I'll just jump there and then I'll go there and then I'll go here. So I had an early crisis, if you like, in my mid-30s, which was, now I see, a bit of a blessing. Found a coach, talked to him on the phone for 6 sessions. That was it. Totally changed my life. And that's when I thought, gosh, I've got to train to do this. And it's because it's not therapy. And, you know, I've done a lot of therapy. That has a great place in people's lives. But coaching sits somewhere else. It's much more forward looking. It can be more positive. It's more accessible. And I think the book, I really wanted to make the whole thing accessible, because not everyone can sit one-to-one with a coach.
And it sounds like what you're saying as well, I think of coaching, what I experienced in sport, as somebody almost telling you what to do. But it sounds like your coaching is letting people come up with the answers themselves, almost, that you're guiding them and the answers are already within.
Yeah, absolutely, Gabby. I mean, you know, you're absolutely right. From sport, you want someone to say, look, to change that, do this. And so you understand the power of coaching, but life coaching or business coaching, as Lorraine will have experienced with Alex, is very different in the sense, really what you're there to do is ask really good, difficult, challenging questions and be a support alongside as the client explores that.
Thank you so much for your time today, Ed, and best of luck with the book, The Modern Maverick. We will hopefully see you again sometime soon on The Midpoint.
I'd love that. Thanks very much.
I think, you know, you're somebody who you can pick the phone up and pretty much speak to anybody you want to speak to because of your job that you've had. You've got massive, you must have a huge contacts book. But actually, you know, in life, not everybody has those, you know, those avenues, do they, to get to people. And I think the emergence of this, you and I are both a bit nervous, I think, about going, oh, it's a bit woo-woo. But actually, Ed kind of told us there straight, didn't he? That there is a part of psychology that is really important. It's not just about treating people when things are going wrong. It's about helping people when things are just, you know, not going quite as well as they would like. And whether that's a coach or you pick up a book, and it might be your book, it might be Ed's book, I think these resources and tools are really helpful for people.
Yeah, I think it's exactly what's needed for this time and for this moment, isn't it? Particularly, I think for women, podcasts are particularly good because they can listen to them privately and do it on their walks and fit it into their day on their, you know, kind of commute. That information is now out there, and you know, I can ring people up as a journalist. I mean, you know, we can just say we're doing a piece on this, we want to know more. So we've got to share that information, and we've got to make sure that it's there on social media, and you curate your feed so that you get that kind of detail that you need around this particular point. And I'm just so glad the conversation is being had, because we have heard on the podcast, and I have heard personally, such appallingly sad stories of women, you know, who are suicidal, and, you know, women who have tried to take, who've written their notes because they've just been ambushed by something which can be helped. You know, whether you can take HRT or not, there are strategies and there is loads of knowledge out there. And it just feels that this, we've really got to get that information out now so that people don't feel alone, and also husbands and partners of women going through something that they've never heard of, that they don't know anything about. Employers tackling huge chunks of the workforce leaving because they don't know how to help or how to support. So I think it's just that information is there. And I think even the woo-woo bits, which I shan't use that word anymore, thank you very much, Ed, even those bits are really, really useful, because it's all rooted in positive psychology, which is rooted in, make you know, the mind-body link, making you feel better. And I don't think that's a privileged middle class thing to be talking about. I think that is relevant in every, you know, I do a lot of work mentoring teenagers and young women as well. And I do a lot of work with mental health experts. And I volunteered for a helpline, which helps young people as well. So everywhere, these strategies are very much part of the message we are getting out. So they are effective for everybody from every background.
One of the reasons why I said yes to go on the Freeze the Fear program with Wim Hof was because the two central tenets to that were cold water and breathing, and they're both free. You know, you can have a cold shower and you can learn how to breathe properly. And it wasn't a show that was telling people to go and spend thousands, you know, on a retreat somewhere, or to go and do, which is great if you can do that, or, you know, go off to some kind of silent retreat in South America or something, as I heard somebody did for a whole month of not speaking. It wouldn't be very good for the podcast. So it had to be accessible, and it had to be something that people can adopt quite easily.
It was a huge journey for you. I mean, watching you doing the breathing was so extraordinary, and I remember feeling some of those things when I've been learning to breathe for getting in very, very cold. You know, I've gone down to 0 degrees at the Lido, but it's watching what you went through just made me think, you know, this is so important that this is accessible to everybody.
Can we talk a little bit about mental sharpness and how you feel now about accessing, you know, those parts of your brain that felt like they were shutting down when you were in those perimenopausal darker days? Do you feel like you've got that back, that or do you want to get that back? Did you want to be back to that person that you felt you were before?
I wanted to be able to remember things, and I wanted to be able to get stuff done so that I could lead a kind of fairly calm life with a house of four kids. But what I didn't want and don't ever want back again is the relentlessness of having to remember a million different things and be in a million different places and do it all at the same time and achieve each and each of those places. And to, you know, I wanted to stop, you know, leaning into things, and I wanted to set boundaries where I could say, you know what, no, and no is enough. I don't even need to explain myself. I'm not going to do that because I don't want to. And it will make me feel I deal with stress in a very, very different way now I'm older. And I look back and recognize that a lot of what I dealt with was extreme stress situations. When you're in that manic situation, you just keep going, and it's learnt behavior. You just push through and you move to the next thing, to the next thing. And you're maybe not your best self around other people. And it's really not good for the body. And I look back and I don't ever want to be in that place again. And I want to be able to have moments between things, even if it's, you know, just an evening between something. And that's what you get. So the upside of this midlife point, and you know, we often feel as if I'm just saying what a negative place it is, the upside is you are so much more confident. You know who you are, you've got all inside you, you can start to access it. I've sort of started in my mid-50s. You feel positive every day, and when stuff goes belly up, then you can deal with it, and it's not the worst thing in the world. And it doesn't matter if you fail, you might fail, and it doesn't matter if you don't get it all done. As long as you have the people around you you love and you're good with them and you've looked after yourself, I think that's the important thing. I've really started to say no to loads of things that I would normally have said yes to. Mm.
Yeah, and as you say, I think I've started to say no. The next bit I've got to learn from you is I don't feel like I have to give a paragraph of reasons why.
No, I just say no. Will you be able to do like no? I think, you know.
I do to my agent. I'll say to her, no, because I'm out two nights after that. Yeah. Or, you know, I'm sorry, I can't go to that event because I've got, you know, I've got something the following night and I'm not doing four nights out on the bounce. That's
I
not
got,
happening.
Asked Whereas, to go on Newsnight recently, and I thought, oh, what a great opportunity. That'd be brilliant. I've got a book out. And then I thought, do you know what? The last time I went on Newsnight, I think I was nearly sick in the waistband. I was so nervous and so distressed. And I thought, do you know, I'll just say no, because it will be terrible and it will be awful, and I won't come across brilliantly because I will get stressed, I will forget everything, and I just don't, you know, I didn't go to uni, and I didn't, you know, I always have that slight worry that I'm not quite smart enough for places, and I used to just say yes to all those things to prove the point to myself, and I just thought, I'm going to say no because that will be too stressful thing for me to do.
And you've done it. You've done it before. You don't need to do it again. And you look great, Lorraine. And, you know, your skin's shiny and your hair's... Oh, your hair's shiny, sorry. Your skin's glowing. Get it the right way around. Yeah. You talk a little bit about food and your relationship. You know, kind of you talk a bit about alcohol as well in there and kind of how that has an effect on you. Are you now a place where you're kind of eating very mindfully and you have a good relationship with the foods that are good for you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm a terrible cook. And I think as a generation, we probably all have a slightly odd, disordered attitude to eating. And you know, we've often seen it as calories. And we've often seen that, you know, we've grown up through the cabbage soup diet and Bridget Jones' Diary, where she recorded her weight. And we found that funny. I mean, I look back now and think that wasn't funny. That's not, you know, that's psychologically so wrong. And I think all of that plays into our attitudes towards food. And I've been very careful not to pass that on to I've got three daughters and a son, pass that on, I hope. But, you know, I'm pretty healthy now because it's almost immediate. If I eat unhealthy food, then I feel terrible the next day. If I drink too much, I feel terrible the next day. You know, I mean, I love chocolate and I love a hobnob, but I try not to worry about it. And one of the points I made in the book is I think your appearance also is probably the least important thing about you at this stage. I tested Botox for a piece I was writing for a paper, and I was kind of liked it for the first sort of 2 days, and then I just was, it didn't really bother me after that. I thought, this, you know, the thing is, once you start that, and if that's how you choose to, absolutely fine, I make no judgment on it. But once you start that, then you start worrying about other things, and you know, and I think it's, you know, it's up to everybody individually, but it is that you learn as well from cold water swimming, because you are around so many people who are almost always naked, trying to get really warm really quickly, fearful of getting hypothermia, that it isn't really important, that it isn't really intrinsic to who you are. And you just get used to the changes.
But I think you start to value your health so much more than you do any aesthetic kind of appeal almost. You think, well, I'm here and I can move and I can function and my body's still letting me play sport, whether it's, you know, go to the gym or play tennis or go for a run. It's still letting me do all those
things. Role models are ahead of us now, aren't they? There are some brilliant role models, and I just don't think they were there before. You can either do it the J-Lo way, which is great for you, great for her, that's her actual job, or you can do it in the way the lady down the road decides it's meaningless to her and she can wear what she wants and do, you know. But we haven't ever seen older women ahead of us being fit, you know, taking up weightlifting at 60, and all, it's just not been around us. And or if it has, it's been, you know, for her age has always been added afterwards. And I think that's now beginning to stop happening, because I think we're realizing that we're valued in many different ways, and that, you know, I'm the fittest and healthiest I have ever been at 54. So I kind of think that's a bonus, because it's a privilege to still be here, you know.
Yeah, I think that should be the title of your next book, For Her Age.
I know, it's just, I find that so, that does make me quite cross. I mean, we didn't mention the rage that comes in. You know, women get this terrible rage, which is part of the perimenopause, but once you've sorted that out, you can still access the rage, and I use it.
Well, Kathleen Moran talks about that, doesn't she? How important that you can use that rage very positively.
Exactly.
And we know so many women of our generation who are using it in lots of different ways to, you know, take on causes and fight fights that they feel are really important. So it's a very good use of the rage. Lorraine, I hope the book does really well. It's a great read. So thank you so much for sharing so much of you in it and helping other people.
And thank you for having me on and for consistently banging the drum about women getting this information, which you've been doing as well. So thank you.
Lorraine really is such a wonderful person to talk to about all the shades of midlife, and I admire all the work she's doing to raise awareness and eradicate feelings of shame for women when they experience changes in their minds and bodies. Her new book, What's Wrong With Me? 101 Things Midlife Women Need to Know, is a cracking read, whatever gender you are, because as she says, you can't go through this stuff alone. Families need to know what's going on. Big thanks to Ed Haddon as well for his thoughts on positive psychology and how it's never too early or too late to sit down and evaluate your definition of success. And I love reading all your thoughts on what we should cover on the podcast. So please join our Facebook page, The Midpointers, or you can DM me on Instagram at Gabby Logan. And a special thanks to Spiritland Productions for putting this together. I hope you can join me next time. Bye-bye for now.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.